If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. George V has gone down in the history books as something of a dullard, a man about whom there is little to say. But according to a new biography by Jane Ridley, both George and his reign contain much more to be fascinated by. On the throne from 1910 to 1936, George witnessed an immensely tumultuous era and helped keep Britain's monarchy afloat as others across Europe crumbled. I spoke to Jane to find out more. Before you tell us what you've uncovered about George V in this new biography that you've written, can you give us an idea of what George's reputation has traditionally been like? How has he gone down in history?
Well, George V reigned from 1910 to 1936. And he has been seen really as a sort of a king who just filled a gap between two rather better known kings. So his father was Edward VII, who was a charismatic, rather scandalous, fashionable playboy king, a sort of, you know, a big man. And then George V was ultimately, after the crisis of the abdication, when his eldest son abdicated from the throne, he was succeeded by George VI, and he is well known too. You know, he was the king of the Queen's speech with the terrible stutter, and he was the king who took Britain through the Second World War and set up a very important relationship with Churchill and all of that. So between these two well-known kings, George V has rather sort of languished. Little has been written about him, little has been said about him.
As you say, I think he's quite often painted as a fairly flat figure. He's almost a cardboard cutout king, isn't he? But how should we see him?
Well, George V has been seen as you say, as a cardboard cutout, and as a sort of a rather dull king. And critics have said at the time and later have said, you know, that his court was very dull, that he himself was a rather dull man without any of the sort of cultivation of, you know, the arts and things that a king should have. When I started work, that was the idea that I had. And people would say to me, you know, how are you going to deal with the dullness? But as I went on, I realised that actually he was not at all dull. Certainly the period in which he was reigning, you know, never a dull moment, as Tommy Lassell said, and is the subtitle of my book. It was an incredibly tumultuous, difficult period in British history. And what's extraordinary about George V is that this man, who was essentially a Victorian, I mean, his grandmother, Queen Victoria, died when he was only, was he 35, that he was able to steer Britain through, and the monarchy, through all these problems, and actually end up with more political stability and a stronger monarchy than it had been at the beginning. So he had a very sure touch with politics.
We'll definitely return to some of those tumultuous events of his reign later, as you say, because this was a really, really pivotal moment in the history of monarchies across Europe. But just to return to George himself briefly, if he wasn't dull then, what can we say about him as a person, his personality, his character?
Well, George's character is it's well hidden, but basically I think George V, in some ways, he was a typical British country squire. He enjoyed country sports, particularly shooting, game shooting, bird shooting, pheasant shooting, grouse, all that sort of thing. He was an excellent shot. He was extremely accurate. He was one of the top five or six shots of his generation in Britain at a time when standards were very high indeed. He was a countryman. He was always much happier at Sandringham in the country or at Balmoral than he was at Buckingham Palace. He was also, in his private views, very Tory, you know, on the right of politics. But he developed the knack. He understood the crucial thing for a modern monarch, which is, have your private views, but the job is about being above party politics. And that was, I think, very important.
That raises something really interesting, I think, which is the fact that he is, quote, dull, whether he is or not, has been levelled against him as a criticism. But really, did you want monarchs at this time that were flamboyant, that were out there? Or did you want somebody who was reliable, sensible, dependable?
I think that's a very good point. I think part of his strength, indeed, was his dullness, if you like, ordinariness, whatever we call it. The fact that he was sensible, that he was predictable. If we'd had, a flamboyant court, a playboy king, mistresses, sexual scandals, etc., during the First World War, I think it would have been seriously difficult. He once said to Ramsay MacDonald, one of his prime ministers, "You have found me an ordinary man." And he understood that being an ordinary man was, as you're suggesting, a strength. It put him in touch with so many of his people.
One thing that you do say about him was that, in your words, he was woefully badly educated. Did that have a negative impact on his ability to take on his role as monarch?
Well, George's education was extraordinary. Poor. He was sent off from a very early age on various sort of training ships to become a naval officer with his older brother, who actually died when he was 28. His older brother, Eddie, didn't want to go into the Navy at all. And these two princes were sort of educated in this sort of bizarre way, sailing around the world with one tutor. And really, George actually learnt a lot about being a naval officer. He was good at that. He came top in all the exams and he did very well. But he didn't have any education in languages or culture or history or any of that sort of background. I used to think that was a huge disadvantage, being uneducated, for a job which is, after all, incredibly sort of demanding. But in fact, looking at George's career, I think the point about him was that he was actually intelligent, that he learned. He knew how to learn from experience. I think that it was that, more than anything, that enabled him to be a good king. I don't think he was too handicapped by being undereducated. And actually, he was a great reader throughout his life. He read a book a week.
Something you emphasise throughout the book is the importance of George's wife, Queen Mary. And you say as well that you almost wrote this as a joint biography. So why is she such a fascinating figure to you?
Oh, Queen Mary, I mean, in her own right, is a fascinating figure because of all her sort of interests. I mean, we say that George wasn't interested in art and antiques, but Queen Mary was absolutely obsessed by these topics. And so she played a really crucial part in the founding and curating of the Royal Collection. She herself was an incredibly enthusiastic curator, and all over the royal palaces, there are bits of furniture with labels on in Queen Mary's handwriting, identifying important pieces of furniture. But above all, Queen Mary had huge interest in jewellery and in accumulating more and more jewellery for the crown jewels. So she performed a part of the role of monarch that George didn't. But I think more important than that, more central than that to the success of George's reign, was the fact that this was a really strong marriage. And I think if you look at successful monarchs in Britain in the 20th century, it is the ones with the strong marriage, with a strong sort of consort, who come out the best. I mean, obviously, we heard an awful lot about this when Prince Philip died, about the role that he played as consort to the Queen, as sort of the power behind the throne. We didn't know what was going on, but it was crucially important. And I think the same is true of Queen Mary and George V. But this marriage between George V and Queen Mary, was a partnership. And although she didn't sort of appear publicly in political functions, he discussed everything with her. He always told her everything first. And that was really important to not just to their relationship, but to the monarchy.
Mm. And as part of that partnership, you say that George was an intensely domestic man. Was that the primary way that his public image was taken to the people? Was that the main image of kingship that he wanted to represent?
I think particularly after the First World War. He wanted to represent the image of a family on the throne. So that with at the centre of that family, this very, you know, the marriage, but also his six children. The idea of a domestic family monarchy, that was really important. And of course, that idea was the basic idea of the 20th century monarchy in Britain.
You also talk about something you refer to as the mystique of George's monarchy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there's always with monarchy a sense that, you know, we see the public sees whatever they see. But that if you let daylight in, you will see much more. And that there was a sort of magic about monarchy. And this was felt even, at the time that George was king at the beginning of the 20th century, that it's not just a matter of being a sort of humdrum family on the throne. It's also the fact that because he's king, there is a sort of a magical ability to communicate with his people. And I suppose one sort of thing that exemplifies this is the Christmas broadcast that begin right at the end of the reign in the 1930s. Direct communication between this sort of grandfather figure, the grandfather of his people, and his people who are turning on their wirelesses on Christmas afternoon to listen to the king's speech.
So he was generally quite a popular king?
For most of his reign, he was quite a popular king, certainly. There was a slightly bumpy bit at the end of the First World War. You know, it was a period of unrest, a period of lots of soldiers coming back, demobilised, not finding any jobs, period of unemployment, strikes, etc. George was very much alarmed by reports of the growth of socialism and what he called Bolshevism, the influence from Russia spreading to Britain. And he did respond to that by trying to make the monarchy more in touch with the people by himself doing things like going to football matches and being seen at football matches, that sort of thing.
Before we move on to the First World War and the impact of that, I just wanted to return to the start of George's reign because I found it quite intriguing that he didn't become king until he was 44, which was quite late. Do you think the fact that he had such a long span of adulthood before he made it to the throne helped him when he did ascend?
Well, it should have helped him because he had a lot of time to prepare for being king. 44, he'd had about sort of 20 years to prepare for being king. And it is true that he did at the beginning of that period, he did engage a tutor, and they read together, you know, the famous book by Walter Badgett, The English Constitution, which is the famous classic statement of the constitutional role of the monarch. So he did do a little bit of trying to educate himself, but really not very much. Quite soon he got fed up with Badgett. He wasn't getting anything from it that was going to be helpful to him, he thought, and I understand that, actually. It's interesting, his period as Prince of Wales, there was very little pressure put on him by his father to sort of step up to the plate and do a lot of public work. I think there was a feeling that, because his brother had died in such terrible circumstances, and very sudden death from pneumonia, and George himself hadn't really expected to become king, there was a feeling that he needed to be treated with great sort of gentleness and not pressured and not pushed. So George really continued his life to a large extent when he was Prince of Wales, as he had done before, being a sort of country squire and spending a lot of time in the country, shooting and on other such occupations. He didn't do a great deal of sort of public work. And so when he does become king, he's learning on the job and he learns very quickly.
So let's return to the First World War now. During that conflict, many of the nations that Britain was fighting against had monarchs that had close blood ties with George. They were his first cousins. So I'm talking about Tsar Nicholas and I'm talking about Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany. Was that a strain on him or were those family ties really only ones of blood that didn't extend to a personal relationship?
Oh, I think the First World War was incredibly stressful from that point of view for George. I mean, you know, Britain's enemy was Germany. And, of course, the Kaiser was George's first cousin, George's rather difficult first cousin. George actually, I don't think he found much difficulty in seeing the Kaiser as his enemy. He'd never much liked the Kaiser. And I think far more difficult and conflicted was the relationship with his other emperor first cousin, Nicholas II of Russia. Because George had had a very affectionate relationship with Nicky, as he called him. He always says in his diary when he meets him, "Dear Nicky," you know, was charming as ever. They got on very well at a personal level. And also they looked identical. And when they were together, people really couldn't tell the difference, which was which. One of the really sort of crucial interludes in George's reign is what to do when the Russian Revolution comes along and Nicky is forced to abdicate. And the Russian government, the provisional Russian government, the liberal government of Russia, who wanted to stay in the war, approached the British government and asked Lloyd George, is it possible for the British to give the Tsar asylum? And Lloyd George, who's desperate for Russia to stay in the war, says, you know, of course we'll do this, we'll do our best. But it becomes increasingly clear that the king is not in favour of this. And certainly Lord Stamfordham, the king's private secretary, is very busy trying to sort of undo this offer of asylum. And I think there's little doubt that George knew all about this and was even behind it. I mean, Stamfordham couldn't have refused asylum to the king's first cousin without the king being on side with that decision.
Which is interesting, because you just said that they had this personal affection. They were obviously first cousins. So why did George take that stance that was opposed even to the British political establishment?
It's really interesting. George believed, rightly or wrongly, that if the Tsar came to this country, that it would undermine the position of his own monarchy. He believed that it would cause Bolshevism to spread, that it would be certainly something that, you know, the Labour Party would find very hard to accept. And it was basically a decision that he made for dynastic reasons, to preserve his own throne. And possibly he was right.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And so there's a huge difference between, you know, the heir to the throne, who is photographed, you know, in a swimming pool or whatever it might be, living this film star life, and the king just sort of doing his duty and never going abroad and endlessly doing this sort of these good works.
Because we can tell with hindsight, can't we, that the Romanovs obviously were later executed. But did George know that he was essentially signing a death warrant for his cousin when he made that decision?
That is a good question. When he made that decision, Russia still has the liberal provisional government. He did not realise, in fact, that there was no way that the Tsar could escape. Because the Petrograd Soviets were and their sort of armies were guarding the Tsar in his palace. There were thousands of troops. Would have been impossible for the Tsar and his entourage to escape. And in fact, you know, Nicholas II seems completely out of touch with reality. He sort of replies, "Yes, it's very kind of you to offer me asylum, but I really can't come until the children have recovered from measles." And there's a school of thought that Nicholas II, anyway, believed that his destiny as a Romanov was to die in his country. So I think it's unlikely that whatever George had decided, it's unlikely that the Tsar would have come anyway. And nobody really knew how bloody the Russian Revolution would become. But if you look at revolutions in the past, such as the French Revolution or even the English Revolution, Charles I lost his head, and so too did the King of France. I think that it was pretty likely that this would happen to anybody who knew any history.
As the story you just told makes clear, this was an era when many of Europe's monarchies crumbled. How much do you think that George and Queen Mary can be credited with the survival of the British monarchy?
I think the British monarchy was in a stronger position than many of the other European countries that monarchies that crumbled. But I think that George and Queen Mary did a lot to preserve it as well. I mean, you know, the key factor, perhaps, was that the British monarchy was a constitutional monarchy. And therefore, when the First World War broke out, there was no expectation that the king would have anything to do with the direction of the war, or that he should head his troops as the Tsar did, or anything like that. So his role during the First World War was to basically keep up morale, and especially the morale of soldiers. I think that obviously one factor that hugely helped the survival of the monarchy was the fact that we actually won the war. If Britain had been defeated, it might all have been a very different story. It was military defeat that brought down the Tsar and brought down the Kaiser. But their positions were both weaker politically in their countries than the position of the King of England. I think what you know, what George and Mary do during the war is essentially to give an example of living, you know, only eating meat twice a week or whatever it might be, giving up alcohol for the duration of the war, and more than that, perhaps the sort of service, you know, endless visits. If you look at George's diary for the war years, it's almost impossible to make a sort of pattern of what's going on, because every day is just full, clogged with these visits to hospitals, or visits to see soldiers off who are going off to France, or people coming to be decorated with medals. He was incredibly busy, and that sort of dedication, I think, was something that also played very much in his favour.
And the First World War wasn't the only challenge of George's reign. To return to that Tommy Lassell's quote, there was never a dull moment. So what were some of the other moments of crisis or challenge that the monarchy faced in that time?
Well, I think one of the most important moments of challenge that the monarchy faced was the rise of the Labour Party and the first Labour government of 1924. This came about as a result of a hung parliament. And so there was a decision to be made by the king at that time, which leader to appoint as prime minister. And George had no doubt that it was Ramsay MacDonald, the leader of the Labour Party, who should become prime minister. And so this is really extraordinary. And George himself realised how extraordinary it was that he, the King of England, should be appointing or enabling, facilitating the first Labour government. And he went out of his way to make things easier for him than for other parties. He was as is a martinet when it came to wearing the correct clothes at court and wherever. He would write cross notes to people who wore the wrong hat with the wrong waistcoat or whatever it might be. But when it came to the Labour Party, they were allowed to wear basically whatever they liked. Because George was aware that these court clothes were extremely expensive and that many Labour MPs couldn't or cabinet ministers couldn't afford them. And he has this very friendly relationship with Ramsay MacDonald, the Labour leader. And in fact, he gets on better with Ramsay MacDonald, I would say, than any other prime minister. And so on the day that Ramsay MacDonald became prime minister, George wrote in his diary, you know, Ramsay MacDonald, prime minister, I wonder what grandmother, grandmama, that's to say Queen Victoria, would have made of that.
It's intriguing, isn't it? Because as you mentioned earlier, that he was personally very Tory. So this seems contradictory, but is it just an example of his ability to separate personal and political, I guess, his state work, his personal life and his state work?
It is indeed an example of his ability to separate his personal life and his personal views and his public role. Certainly it is. And I think... from the point of view of the public role, encouraging the Labour Party to form a government was incredibly important. Remember, this is a time of fascism and Nazism, etc. And if you can contain the political left within the constitution, rather than sort of, forcing them to work outside it and become more extreme.
You mentioned that his relationship with Ramsay MacDonald was perhaps the best of the four prime ministers that were during his reign. Can you give us an idea of the other three and how he got on with them?
Well, two prime ministers who he didn't get on with very well were Asquith, who was prime minister when he became king, And Asquith treated George very badly and misled him over a very important thing about the constitutional crisis. And from that point onwards, George decides that it's really important that he should sort of keep clear of party politics. I mean, it was educational for George. But the Prime Minister, who he really doesn't like, is Lloyd George. And Lloyd George, who, of course, comes to power with a brief, basically, to win the war and to be much more proactive in running the war. Lloyd George is constantly receiving letters from the palace saying, you really should ask me before you create people peers. You really should answer my letters. Lloyd George treats the king really badly. He doesn't answer letters. At one point, he even actually failed to turn up for an appointment with the king, which was something, and still would be today, completely unheard of. His sort of, the basic courtesy that Lloyd George should have extended to the king just is not there. And Lloyd George was well aware of this. Lloyd George was Britain's first working class prime minister. He certainly sympathised with, Republican politics. And certainly at the beginning of his time as prime minister, he has no time for the king at all. After they've been working together for quite a bit, they do actually sort of, relations do improve. But by far the most difficult prime minister for George is Lloyd George. And the one he also, I think it's rather interesting that Baldwin, Tory prime minister and Tory sort of leader for much of this period, is somebody who the king finds quite difficult to get on with. He gets on much better with Ramsay MacDonald.
So the world looked very different in 1936 than it had in 1910. And George was still there. What do you think was the secret to his success, almost, his ability to weather all these storms? What do you think was behind that?
I think that politically, the secret of his success was his realization that it was no good for the monarch to try and impose his own political views. That his job was different. His job was to be above party and to try and, create agreement where possible. And also his job, for example, over Ireland, where there was a threat of civil war in 1914, his job in that sort of circumstance was essentially to prevent his subjects from killing one another. It wasn't about party politics. It transcended. It was higher than party politics in his view. So I think that was one thing. And I think the second thing that was really important to George's success was his projection of this image of a family monarchy, and which was in touch with the families of his country, a sort of a rather a modest and rather humdrum monarchy, which understood how ordinary people felt.
After all these years of a stable monarchy, when George died, the monarchy faced one of the biggest crises in its modern history, the abdication crisis. Did George know that he was going to leave a chaotic scene when he died? How aware was he of what was going to happen?
George was pretty aware of. George was probably not aware of the actual abdication, but he was aware that there were problems with the succession. So George had a long-standing quarrel with his eldest son and heir, the Duke of Windsor. While George was sort of on his deathbed, practically, he was distraught to discover that the Duke of Windsor was having an affair with Mrs. Simpson, Wallis Simpson, this American twice-divorced woman, totally unacceptable in George's view. He had hoped that he would be able to have a conversation with his son and persuade him to withdraw from the succession. So in a sense, there's a sort of paradox here that, George, who was so keen on projecting the image of a family monarchy, actually, when it came to it, the crucial thing that a king needs to do, which was to ensure the succession, was something that he failed to do. That, it was still very unclear indeed what would happen when he died. And of course, what does happen is that his son, the Duke of Windsor, takes the throne, and then very shortly after that, abdicates. And in a sense, you could say that all of this is down to George, that he hadn't, or to an extent down to George, that he hadn't really prepared for the succession. But I think on the other hand, you have to say that the fact that the abdication was really not a big deal, you know, it was quite easily put right, and that George VI stood up to the plate and became a very good monarch, and that the monarchy itself was strong, all that was George's achievement.
Mm. And you say in the book that the rift with his son, his elder son, the Duke of Windsor, must count as one of George's greatest failures. Was that rift just about his son's relationship with Wallace Simpson, or was it more longstanding?
The rift with his son, the Duke of Windsor, goes back really to the First World War. Even as a little boy, you know, the Duke of Windsor hadn't got on with his father very well. But basically, I suppose the best way to see it is as being a sort of expression of the generation gap that opens up between the older generation who'd sort of got Britain into this war and the younger generation who become, you know, sort of the roaring 20s and throw away all the sort of Victorianism of their parents. The Duke of Windsor was an extremely trendy figure. And he did these incredibly successful empire tours, that exhausting empire tours that he was sent on by his father and by the Lloyd George, the Prime Minister. And, you know, he was a kind of film star figure. And so there's a huge difference between, you know, the heir to the throne who is photographed, you know, in a swimming pool or whatever it might be, living this film star life, and the king just sort of doing his duty and never going abroad and endlessly doing these good works. And I suppose there's a bit of jealousy. I think that George was jealous of his son's popularity. But there is also the fact that from a quite early age, the Duke of Windsor didn't really want to be king. He knew he'd been a very good Prince of Wales, and he was quite happy to leave it at that.
So finally, how should we amend our view of George if we don't want to just dismiss him as a dullard that came between two more interesting people? How should we see him instead?
Well, I think we should see him as the founder of the modern monarchy and also the king who saved the monarchy from the potential danger of the First World War and its political impact.
That was Jane Ridley. Her biography, George V, Never a Dull Moment, is out now, published by Chatto & Windus. You can find plenty more on the history of the royal family at historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.